Welcome to Bible's Weekly Podcast. I'm very pleased to have with us Hannah Lucinda Smith, who is the Times Turkey correspondent. She's also got a book out at the moment called Erdogan Rising, The Battle for the Soul of Turkey, which is available in all good bookshops and on Amazon. I urge you to buy it, to read it. It's an excellent book, very well reviewed. Welcome to the podcast, Hannah.
Thank you.
So you're obviously very busy filing all sorts of reports about what is going on at the moment in northern Syria and with Turkish forces sending in ground troops, attacking various places on the border. I mean, I wanted to just sort of kick off with just, I suppose, giving us a sense of what you think is really, what is President Erdogan trying to achieve here? I mean, we're sort of seeing the story as very much a sort of, President Trump abandoning the Kurds, what's going to happen with ISIS, but there's a much clearer, I suppose, deeper game, which is about Erdogan and the Kurds and about Turkey, which I, if you could explain for us.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think this is something that's been really overlooked in most of the media coverage. We need to look at Erdogan's domestic reasons for doing this. Increasingly over the past 5 years, Erdogan has used foreign policy for domestic ends. So specifically, whenever his kind of domestic support starts slipping or he's facing a domestic crisis, he will use or ramp up a foreign crisis in order to regain that support and to galvanize his base. So we've especially seen this in the three operations that he's done on the ground in Syria, this being the third. So the first one came 6 weeks after the failed coup attempt. It was at a time when the army was undergoing a massive purge. This was an operation on paper to drive ISIS away from the Turkish border, but of course also to stop the Kurds coming towards the Turkish border. Now, the second operation in Afrin, which was from January 2018 to March 2018, was followed very, very swiftly by early elections, which Erdogan then won. And, what we saw then was Erdogan really riding on the jingoism and the nationalism and all the symbolism of that operation in Afrin, which he framed and was in fact a kind of successful Turkish operation, successful in the sense that the Turks got what they wanted. They've got control of that pocket of Syria. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we saw something very similar happening again. Now, Erdogan has had a really rocky year. The local elections, which were initially held in March, at the end of March, were an absolute disaster for him. He lost control of all of the major cities, including Istanbul, which is his home city. It's the economic powerhouse. It's the cultural centre of Turkey, even if it's not the capital. And then even worse, his decision to recall those elections, claiming that there had been irregularities, claiming that there might have been sort of conspiracies at the ballot box. It really backfired in his face. The opposition won them with a margin that increased 800 times from the original election. He's had a tough year. And although the next elections, parliamentary and presidential, are not due until 2023, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Erdogan, once this operation is done and dusted, no matter how limited or not it might be, then uses it to kind of ramp up jingoistic nationalist support at home and perhaps even call early elections off the back of it.
And he can just do that. He can just call early elections his own choosing.
He can. I mean, he has the power to dissolve parliament, in which case his own post is dissolved as well. So and conversely, parliament can do the same. But we should say that parliament is also controlled by a coalition of his party, the AKP, and the hard right nationalists, the MHP. This is what we saw happen in 2018. Actually, those presidential and parliamentary elections, which were held in June 2018, weren't due to be held until this year. But Erdogan sort of sensed that things were starting to go wrong in the economy and in various other ways. And like I say, off the back of the Afrin operation, then called those elections early.
Right. So these reports and this sort of sense that, Turkey is looking to create this big buffer zone of 370 kilometres wide, 32 kilometres deep, like a really big operation. And this idea of also resettling Syrian refugees there. I mean, is that all just a narrative, or is there any substantive concrete plans to actually achieve that?
Well, with someone as mercurial as Erdogan at this point, it's really hard to tell. But to be honest, James, I mean, I just can't see it happening. I mean, when you look at the size of this proposed safe zone, it's 300 miles long and about 20 miles deep. I mean, that's a huge amount of territory. It's more than double the territory that the Turkish army and allied Syrian rebels are currently controlling, which they're already having kind of tough time administering. And there's, you know, occasionally car bomb attacks in those areas and all sorts of things. I mean, yeah, the reason that he's presenting to his to the Turkish people for launching this operation is twofold. Firstly, to push the Kurdish militia, the YPG, back from the border and therefore improve Turkey's security, although arguably, I would certainly argue that it's going to worsen Turkey's security. And also to resettle, as he said, 2 million of the 3.6 million Syrians that Turkey is now hosting. Now, these are pure populist moves. I mean, firstly, if we look at the idea of a war against Kurdish militants, this is something that plays really well across the entire Turkish political spectrum, not just the nationalists and not just Erdogan supporters. If you look at the comments coming even from the opposition parties over the past few days, they're wholesale supportive, blanket support for this operation. And, you know, if you look at Turkish social media, for example, you will find almost blanket support. It's, you know, a few sort of brave dissenting voices, usually from the intellectuals and the leftists who oppose these operations. And often, in fact, these people will then face criminal charges for doing so. They're accused of supporting terrorists. So that's something that plays very well amongst Turkish people. But also, you know, polls recently in the past few months have shown that Turkish people, again, across the spectrum, across the political spectrum, are getting increasingly frustrated with Turkey's long-term hosting of the Syrian refugees. You know, back in 2011, when refugees first started coming into Turkey and President Erdogan opened his doors and the country's arms to them, he framed it as, you know, we're helping our Syrian brothers, our Muslim brothers. And you know, there was a huge amount of sympathy, especially among Erdogan's own constituency, but I think, you know, across the country. And I think we have to give credit to Turks for what great hosts they have been. You know, 3.6 million refugees in a country of 80 million. And although there are sort of, you know, violent and disturbing incidents, they are isolated. But polls are showing that Turks are, you know, increasingly asking, well, how long is this situation going to remain? Are the Syrians going to be here permanently? If so, how are they going to be integrated? And I think, you know, Erdogan talking about sending 2 million Syrians back to the country is, again, a massive kind of support winner for him.
Mm. And this issue of ISIS as well, I mean, people have looked at and the sort of people insinuate that you know, is Erdogan really going to keep these thousands of ISIS prisoners under lock and key in the same way that the Kurds were? I mean, is there any truth in this idea? I mean, people also criticise the state of the sort of border security in the early days of the Syrian civil war, and that there was, you know, a bit of a revolving door for some of the worst elements to get in and out of Turkey, in and out of Syria. Is there some history there that, you know, Erdogan really has turned a bit of a blind eye in a way to ISIS, and that, you know, he's not necessarily going to be as tight with them as the Kurds were? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about this issue, what we have to be really careful of is avoiding slipping into this narrative that was sort of propagated from about 5 years ago about, you know, Turkey supporting ISIS or Erdogan supporting ISIS. There's absolutely no evidence of kind of, you know, tangible backroom support between Turkey and ISIS. But certainly what we can say, as you said, is that in the early years of the Syrian conflict, there was a massive insecurity at that border. So, in fact, I was based in southern Turkey in the early years of the Syrian conflict. And, you know, I saw for myself how easy it was to traverse that border. In fact, I traversed it myself. You could traverse with a passport, or you could go across well-established smuggling routes. Now, to give Turkey its credit and to give Erdogan his credit, since 2015 and since, you know, ISIS really became a problem, Turkey has massively beefed up security along that border. So they've, in fact, built a concrete wall. It's about, I think, 3 metres high and 2 metres wide all the way pretty much along that border, apart from a small section at the western end where it goes through the mountains. And, you know, it's a heavily militarized area now. And, you know, certainly sort of looking at it from a different perspective, it's, you know, when I talk to refugees inside Syria who are now trying to get out, whereas once they might have paid, you know, $50 to a smuggler and it would have been a matter of half an hour walking across the border, now they're having to pay a couple of $1,000 and, you know, do an incredibly risky journey, climbing over a wall and sort of sprinting under the gaze of the Turkish army. So I think, you know, Turkey has tightened up its border security immensely. However, I think, you know, the bigger question is, if Turkey's going to take control of these prisons and camps where ISIS suspects and their wives and children are being held, how is that handover going to happen? I mean, at the moment, those camps and prisons are controlled by the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the West's allies in Syria, of which the bigger part is Kurdish militias. Now, they're the ones at war with Turkey at the moment. You know, as we've seen, it's a completely chaotic situation there at the moment. So I don't understand practically, and I don't think anyone sort of outlined practically how that handover is going to happen. What we've seen over the past 24 hours is the US moving some of the really high risk ISIS prisoners out of the country. So the two members of the Beatles, Alexander Coty and Al-Shafi Al-Sheikh, who are being held in a prison in Kobani right next to the border, they've been moved into Iraq. And I imagine this could be the case with some of the really kind of, you know, high value and problematic prisoners. But there's about 100,000 ISIS suspects and their wives and children there. Now, how on earth is either that handover going to happen, or are they going to be secured and moved out of the area? I don't know.
And just looking at the bit that sort of, I suppose, kicked all this off and got the world's attention was this Trump conversation with Erdogan, and Trump then announcing what he was going to do. I mean, how did you see that, you know, having studied Erdogan for so long and being there in Turkey? I mean, did you feel that sort of Erdogan got what he wanted from that and he sort of played Trump, or was it the case that, you know, the US were just sort of reiterating, you know, their position that they just didn't really want to get involved? How did you see it from there? And also, how did it play in Turkey?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think this is kind of a high stakes bluff calling by two very mercurial men. I mean, you know, the way that it was initially reported, as if, you know, Trump had greenlighted a Turkish operation in Syria, isn't quite the case. I mean, the withdrawal actually of US forces has been quite limited. It's been about 50 US troops from Tal Abyad and Ras Al Ain, which are two towns on the border. It's where the bulk of the kind of Turkish operation is happening at the moment, and where the ground incursions have happened by Turkish forces. So it's certainly not a kind of full-scale withdrawal of the full US presence there. There's about 1,000 US troops in the area, so 50 is what, 1/20th of that. Now, I think what seems to have happened, judging by A, the Turkish reaction, and B, statements since that initial announcement on Sunday night, is Turkey and the US have been negotiating for several months about setting up this safe zone. They seem to have reached an agreement in August that they would have joint patrols. But at the end of September, Erdogan started getting twitchy. He was saying, you know, the deadline has passed for a full safety zone to be set up. We're going to act unilaterally. Now, as I said before, I think there could be domestic reasons for him doing that rather than, you know, pure foreign policy reasons. But what seems to have happened is, in this phone call with Trump, he presented a Turkish strike on Tal Abyad, where the joint patrols had been set up in August, as a kind of fait accompli. And in response to which, Trump said, OK, we're going to, in that case, withdraw Turkish US troops from that area so they don't get caught in the crossfire. But I think the really interesting part is this bit about Turkey then taking control of the ISIS prisoners, because the statement that's been focused on is the White House statement. Actually, the Turkish presidency also put out a statement after that phone call, and it was very, very different to the White House statement. So what the Turkish statement said was that the two leaders had spoken, that Erdogan had expressed his frustrations, and that they would meet in Washington next month. And that was it. And actually, Erdogan on Monday morning appeared to be a little bit blindsided by this announcement that that he was going to be taking charge of all the ISIS prisoners. He gave a quick briefing to reporters before he flew off to a state visit to Serbia, in which he said, oh, well, we think the estimates are too high. There aren't that many prisoners there, actually. Yes, of course, we can take responsibility for them. And I just think this is just really mercurial, high stakes, bluff calling diplomacy. And of course, you know, it being that doesn't change the fact that it's unleashed a new wave of chaos in an already really chaotic civil war, and already unleashed a new humanitarian catastrophe. I mean, it's already sent thousands of people fleeing from their homes, and we're only in the opening 24 hours of this operation.
Yeah. And then, I mean, there's also, I don't know whether you'd agree with this, but I mean, we're just 3 years away or less from a major a prevented coup, which involved very senior people in the armed forces and huge numbers of arrests and imprisonment, etc. I mean, how capable are the armed forces, and how much of the sort of officer class and the senior officers been affected by all this? I mean, is this something that the Turkish armed forces are up for in terms of capability as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, we can't underestimate the kind of scale and impact of the purge of the armed forces following the coup. Now, to give you a bit of history on this, the army has always been the biggest bastion of secularism in Turkey and the biggest kind of challenge to Erdogan. There was a point in 2007 where the army and the courts tried to close down Erdogan's party. Erdogan actually called a snap election at that point and won it, and sort of neutered the army to an extent at that point. But he's always seen it as his kind of biggest challenger. Now, pretty soon after that coup attempt, the purges within the army started, and the Navy and Air Force also. You know, within days, thousands of people had been arrested or fired. And what the government said was, oh, only 1% of military was involved in the coup. It was limited. But actually, when you look at specifically where the purges have taken place, it's been hitting the top brass particularly. So the army has lost, I think, more than half of its generals at this point. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those generals who have been purged are generals who were always dead set against Erdogan's desires to put Turkish boots on the ground inside Syria. Erdogan's been wanting to do this for a really long time. And in particular, the Second Army, the Turkish Second Army, which is the army that controls and secures the southern borders with Syria and Iraq, were always against it. And all the generals from that Second Army were purged almost immediately after the coup attempt, even though there had been... Yeah, so even though there had been almost no coup activity in that area, that, you know, the heart of the coup was in Istanbul and Ankara, you know, a long way away from the southern borders. And then obviously 6 weeks later, Erdogan launches his first offensive in Syria. That offensive was an absolute disaster. People in Turkey don't necessarily see it as that, because obviously the media is so controlled, but the Turkish army got absolutely bogged down, because a cross-border operation is a really tricky, complex thing to do at the best of times. It's an almost impossible thing to do when you're in the middle of a huge purge of your armed forces, winter's setting in, and you've started it with, you know, almost a moment's planning. So no end of Turkish soldiers were killed by ISIS car bombs and suicide bombers around the town of Al-Bab. It took them months to take the town. Now, since then, they appear to have kind of refined their strategy a bit. So what we saw in Afrin, the next operation, and what we're seeing here is Turkey using Syrian rebel forces as the kind of head of the spear. They're the ones who kind of go on ahead, and Turkish commando special forces are doing the kind of brain work, I guess. So, it's Syrian rebels doing the legwork and Turkish commandos doing the brain work. What's really interesting about these Syrian rebel groups is they're all groups that at some point early in the conflict were backed either by the Pentagon or the CIA. So they were formally backed by the US. Once the US started shifting their attention more towards backing the Kurds against ISIS, Turkey moved in to co-opt these groups. And now, you know, I would hesitate to even call them Syrian rebel groups. They're not fighting against Assad anymore. They are doing Turkey's bidding, absolutely. They're Turkey's ground troops. So, yeah, I mean, I think Turkey has refined the way that it does these operations somewhat. But, you know, we're looking at a military whose brains have been stripped out, whose, you know, dissenting officers have been stripped out. But interestingly, there are still kind of signs of dissent within the ranks. I have to say that, you know, the top rank now is a general called Hulusi Akar, who was the kind of first to stick by Erdogan on the night of the coup. He sort of proved his loyalty early on. He's the defense minister. But last month, what we saw was several generals involved in the Idlib operation, including the commander of that operation, all resigning at once, which I think is a pretty strong signal that there's still, you know, some dissent, at least within the ranks of the Turkish army.
Right. And so, I mean, just finally, I suppose, maybe your predictions, I know it's very hard, but you seem to be leaning towards a more limited operation to look for signs that Erdogan is really using this in many ways for the domestic political situation and try and improve his own standing domestically. And that's the way that this is going to go. And that's what we should be looking out for. That seems to be kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a fool's errand to kind of, you know, say definitively that this or that is going to happen. Like I said before, Erdogan's incredibly mercurial at this stage. But, you know, he has proved again and again in the past that he's perfectly capable of saying one thing one week and having everyone go along with him and sort of change his mind and change the rhetoric quite quickly. And no one really seems to pull him up on it. You know, this is his kind of rhetorical skill, which I think, you know, is probably not immediately obvious if you're not in Turkey and talking to his followers and watching him all the time. He's really skillful at sort of saying he's going to do one thing and then, you know, backtracking without saying he's backtracking and not doing it at all, and then presenting a new plan and presenting that the old plan never happened. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if you know, Turkey carried out quite a limited operation, took the towns of Tel Abyad and Ras Al Ain, which is something really important to note here. These two towns, although they're controlled at the moment by Kurdish-led forces, they're actually Arab-majority towns originally. Now, the Syrian Arabs tend to look on Erdogan far more favourably than the Kurds do. And I think those kind of towns will be far easier for Erdogan to control than somewhere that's, you know, originally Kurdish-majority. And in fact, I was watching kind of live pictures of the allied Syrian groups entering one of those towns earlier today, and there were sort of people lining the streets to greet them. You know, whether or not these people have been rounded up in order to do that, I don't know. But I can imagine that there would be some support amongst the Arab populations for this. And yeah, definitely these are going to be quite easy towns to control. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if actually the operation after a few weeks is, you know, announced a success and completed just with these two towns. And then Erdogan uses that as best he can to his domestic advantage.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much, Hannah, for joining us. We will be looking out for your dispatches in the Times as this progresses. But thank you so much for joining us for the podcast.
Thank you.